This is episode number 109 with Alex Bogowski of the Founder Podcast.
What you need is thirst. You need to be a thirsty human
who is intent on learning.
It's a really fascinating exploration of human potential.
Now.
The Founder Podcast. Even the greatest entrepreneurs had help. If you want to learn from the most successful founders on the planet, you are in the right place. Branson, Mark Cuban, Tony Robbins, Tim Ferriss, Arianna Huffington, Seth Godin, Steve Case, Gary V, Sophia Amoroso, Barbara Corcoran, Damon John. Learn from the greatest minds in business today with interviews hosted by Nathan Chan. This is not your average entrepreneur podcast. The Founder Podcast.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Before we start today's episode, I just want to let you know that our goal at Founder is to help entrepreneurs succeed however we can by giving away high quality content in the form of interviews, blog posts, podcasts, YouTube videos, you name it. We put out so much content to help you. And another interesting project that we're working on right now is partnering with world-class founders like Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills like negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free trainings with founders like this, which is 100% free, just go to founder.com/free. Okay, so now let's talk about today's episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Founder Podcast. My name is Nathan Chan. I am the CEO and publisher of Founder Magazine, and I am your host coming to you live from Melbourne, Australia. What's been happening in my world? A lot of projects, a lot of products we're working on, exciting times. Me and the guys, the Founder team, getting heaps of stuff done, still making that transition from founder to CEO, still trying to be, you know, learning what it takes to be a great leader, taking it one day at a time. But, you know, things are good. I will give you guys a heads up. We do have an epic project we're working on, which I'm really pumped about. It's going to be an amazing body of work. It's a founder coffee table book with the past, you know, 50 plus back issues that we have, rounding up that content and putting it into a brilliantly designed coffee table book. If you would like to know more about it, you can go to foundermag, foundermag.com/book, B-O-O-K, and you can sign up to be notified. It's a project I'm really, really excited about, and I'd love for you guys to help bring it to life. We're probably going to crowdfund it, and yeah, it's going to be a really, really fun project. It's going to be an amazing body of work. So that's what's happening in my world. Now let's talk about today's guest, Alex Bogowski. This guy's, you know, a bit of a living legend when it comes to, you know, a super successful, super, you know, well-accomplished founder and entrepreneur, but also an advertising executive. Alex used to run and started one of the hottest and most reputable advertising firms in the world. And he ended up giving that up just to, I don't know, go on a soul-searching quest or whatever you want to call it. And he's just a super smart guy, really, really gets marketing. He's an investor in companies like Lyft, really, really smart guy and founder now. And he's doing some really, really cool stuff. I feel really humbled and honored to get his time to speak with him. This guy's a serious, serious superstar. I'm just going to leave it at that. He shares a ton of gold, as always. We only bring the gold on this podcast. So yeah, guys, that's it from me. I hope you're enjoying these episodes. Now let's jump into the show. So the first question I ask everybody that we interview is, how did you get your job?
Which job?
I guess the job you're doing right now. How did it all start?
The job I have now? I don't have a job now. That's the goal, is to not have a job. It's taken me a long time. But the job I have now is I invest and I advise. So I don't know how I got that job. I became unemployable after my last job, I guess. I couldn't imagine working for anybody. So, yeah, that's it.
Awesome. So, yeah, look, you know, you're a world famous, you know, designer, marketer, author, consumer advocate. Can you take us back to, you know, your early beginnings? You know, how did it all start out for you? How did you get into, you know, working in the advertising world? Can you take us back just for the audience that are not familiar with your story?
My father was a graphic designer and my mom was an art director for some trade magazines. So my dad had a studio with about 25 people, and he and his brother had a studio, a graphic design studio. And it was just sort of a family business. And I grew up with Grafis was a magazine that would always be around, and Communication Arts. Like, those were the sort of magazines that would be on the coffee table in the house. And, you know, all the friends were other graphic designers. And, you know, they'd play games like, you know, they'd come up with fictitious companies and, you know, who could come up with the best logo in 2 minutes. And everyone would sketch and then they'd like show their logos and people would judge. And so it was just, you know, it was just what we did. And so when it is the family business, I think when you're young, you know, you kind of want to do anything but the family business. So my first attempt at a career was motocross, and I became a, you know, kind of semi, not a very successful pro motocross racer. And along the way, you know, not really kind of skipping college, and my mom probably concerned about my employability if things go south, taught me to do what were mechanicals, called mechanicals at the time, which was the production side of graphic design. And so she said, hey, if you know how to do this, at least you'll always have a job, right? And that was really it. I stopped at some point. I stopped racing because I wasn't good enough, and fell back into the family business essentially.
I see. And how did you end up working and tell us about the story around, you know, Crispin Porter and Bogowski and how all that came about?
I started working in a local agency and for about 2 years. And then I left that and started working, you know, with my dad at his studio, and did that for a couple of years. And I went to a conference, and at the conference, the big theme, so this must have been, this is like probably 30 years ago. The big theme of the conference was the death of print, right? Probably not quite, maybe 27 years ago. It was all about the death of print. And so, you know, I'm a print designer and I'm like, this is not good, you know? And the thing that was going to replace print was VHS cassettes. Everyone was going to watch magazines on VHS tapes instead of flipping through them. And I mean, I don't know if I was the only person who believed it or if everybody believed it, but I thought, man, I got to get into an ad agency because they know how to do video, and I got to learn to do video because print's going to be dead. So I knew this guy, Jeff Porter, that had an agency, and I was doing, you know, a bunch of freelance through the studio with him. And, you know, at some point he offered me a job, and I started, I didn't want it, and then I started to reconsider it, and then I started negotiating, and eventually wound up at what was called Crispin Porter at the time. And Jeff Porter had just joined the agency, and it was called Crispin before that. So Chuck had joined, it was now Crispin Porter, and he convinced me to join, and I started as, I think my title was Senior Art Director.
I see. And, you know, how long did you work there, and tell us what ended up happening in the end.
Well, it was not a very good agency. You know, Chuck was talented. He was a creative director, a writer, and he had been freelance, and then he joined. So, you know, I was employee number 16. So it was a small agency and probably maybe the third best agency in Miami, which, you know, at the time put it way, way down the, you know, whatever the national rankings would be. You know, we were fairly terrible. It was a terrible little agency. So I was employee 16, and Chuck said, you know, we'd go out for beers, and he was like, well, my buddy Pat Fallon, he's got this agency, Fallon, in Minneapolis, and they're just killing it, right? And I didn't know much about advertising, but I, you know, flipped through the annuals and I started to learn about it and started, you know, to realize, oh, there's some people that are really good at this. And, you know, Fallon was obviously a hero in those early days and the work that they were doing. So, you know, Chuck's like, how hard could it be? Essentially, was his sell to me. And we just started grinding away, you know, little by little, doing more and more interesting work and kind of finding our voice and our, you know, what we believed in. We, you know, grew from, you know, those 16 people. And I joined because I thought, you know, in retrospect, I think both Chuck and I, it would have been easier just to start an agency from scratch. Because there's so many things, if you're a bad agency, there's so many things you have to unlearn. Like, so much institutional knowledge that you have to unlearn. And it took years and years, you know. We had policies at the beginning, you know, things like, if you were going to order a desk accessory, you could only order the colored putty. You know, there was, like, shit like that that was built into the culture. But I thought what made it an agency was it had wall-to-wall carpeting and they had, you know, copiers and printers and typewriters. And so, like, to me, the infrastructure was so impressive that I thought that that was, you know, the thing. But anyway, it would have been easier to start from scratch. But we, you know, we eventually, you know, started to carve out kind of a you know, a good local reputation and then eventually a national reputation.
I see. And where did you guys end up, like, end up, just for the audience to get some clarity? Because you're like, you're a world famous, you know, brand, ad, you know, design guy.
Yeah, well, that's nice of you. We eventually, there was, you know, I think at the time the thinking was, our original thinking was, we'll be, you know, we'll get famous locally, then we'll get famous regionally, and we'll become national. And we really got stuck at the regional space and weren't moving past kind of the local, you know, fame and reputation. And we made a decision at one point that we had to get national brands, even if they were much smaller than our local clients. And it was the best decision we ever made. We would pitch $1 million national campaign or national client over a $5 million regional client. And that was a hard decision to make in terms of growth and bottom line. But what it did is a small national client has the same issues as a large national client. You know, and so once we understood that kind of business, once we had created campaigns in that space, it was really easy to translate those stories to any size national client. And, you know, it just unleashed our ability to grow. And we eventually, at the time I left, which was about 6 years ago, we had over 1,000 people and offices all over the world. So,
yeah, wow.
Yeah, there was a lot of growth. It never felt ridiculous or impossible to manage, or even like, you know, the overnight success, you know, it looks like that to some people sometimes, but, you know, it's true. There's always 10 years of work behind that. So, yeah, at some point you lift your head up and you're like, holy cow, you really came a long way.
Yeah. Wow. And
but I tell people, you know, that, yeah, you got to be careful because you can't tell when you're in it. You know, you don't realize how much progress you're making. And so often people get frustrated because it is, look, you know, you could, you know, win the Grand Prix at Cannes, you know. The next day, you're going to go into your office and look at the same dude across the office and try to think of something. It doesn't feel any better. You know, it didn't make you any smarter. It doesn't make anything any easier. So ultimately, and this is, you can't tell people to do this, but in your own journey, I found that I had to learn to love the process and forget all the goals, because the goals didn't, you know, the goals as you achieved them, they didn't really change anything. You know, what you were going to do in life and what you're going to spend time doing was you're going to sit across from somebody and you're going to, you know, think really hard. And if you hated that, then you'd hate your life, no matter how much you achieved. If you began to love that process, then you loved your life. And that was a that was something that for me was that I had to go through. There was a time where I didn't enjoy the thinking of the thing. That was just a way to get to some achievement that I thought I needed. You know, I thought I needed this award, or I thought I needed, you know, that recognition, or that, you know, this client. And then eventually I realized I really just like sitting down with smart people and trying to figure stuff out. And that was my reward, and the rest didn't matter at all. But I don't think you necessarily start there, but for people who, I think it's important to say, because some people might be realizing like, wow, I thought everything would change after I got, you know, this lion, and it didn't. So now what? And my thing is like, learn to love the process.
Mm. So what ended up happening? Like, you ended up leaving, and then, you know, now you're, you know, why did you leave? Out of curiosity? You just fell out of love with the process?
No, well, combination of things. Agencies, they sell to holding companies, you know? And we had a really long, what they call an earnout, right? So there's the moment that you begin the process of selling, and then there's the earnout. So the way it typically works is a holding company buys a portion, maybe half, maybe 49%, whatever it is. And then there's a period of time where they work towards 80%, so that they can file. And since they're public companies, they need to move towards 80% ownership. And that process usually is like a 5-year process. Ours was 10 years. I think maybe over 10 years. So it was a long process because we had, you know, we were on a good roll and we didn't want to stop doing what we were doing. And, I probably wouldn't have been anxious to sell, but Chuck Porter's, you know, he's about 10 years older than I am, and he was in different stages of his life and needed to unlock some equity in the firm and stuff. And so, the sale happened, and then, you know, over time that 10 years goes by and then you don't own it anymore. And to me, that was a very different feeling. And honestly, I'd always figured, you know, I really enjoyed advertising, but I never figured I would do it my whole life. You know, in the back of my head, there was always this feeling like, yeah, I'll do other stuff later. And so, you know, when the sale was over, to me, it was just an opportunity to, you know, try some other things. And largely, which I'd always thought I would do, I've always been like that. Like, I'll make these decisions, and I barely even know I make them, but they're kind of etched in stone. And I knew I would leave when we were done with the selling. And then the other thing that had happened is, with the growth, which was fantastic, and I really don't, you know, I never felt like growth and quality were at odds.
Mm.
But near the end, there's not many accounts that are large enough to have an impact on your P&L at that size.
Mm.
So you're talking about really big companies. And what I loved about advertising is I love the kind of culture jamming. You know, but being part of the changes in culture and the searching of culture, like what's next, what's hot, right?
Mm.
But when you've got larger clients, your job is to support the status quo. And that was much less exciting than when we had smaller clients and our job was to upset the status quo.
Mm.
So that to me, I felt much less alignment with what I was doing and the people I was, you know, not the people I needed to, and the clients I was doing it with. It just wasn't quite as much fun. So, you know, opportunity to like switch gears and have more fun.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. So, you know, you've done so many, you know, award-winning campaigns and Adweek, you know, magazine has, you know, you got named creative director of the decade. So I've got to ask you, and I'm sure our audience would love to hear, can you give us some sort of an insight around your creative process or anything that can be tapped into that? Now, I know obviously it can't be replicated, but I think people might find that interesting.
I think most people probably have trouble describing their creative process. A lot of people, you know, like to kind of be inspired by things they read or that, you know, I was always inspired by things I read, and I noticed that any book I was reading, I could tell how it would influence the work, but I didn't do it for inspiration. I never felt like I needed to load myself up with knowledge of pop culture. I thought that was fairly natural. I didn't, you know, select what I was going to read. It might be fiction, it might be nonfiction, it might be marketing, it might be, you know, a graphic novel. It didn't matter. My feeling is the right inspirations are just, they naturally find you. So, you know, I never spent much time thinking about how to be inspired. When it came to the work, I really gravitated towards great strategy. And it took, for me, we didn't have planning for years and years and years. And I became a champion of, like, you know, getting planning into the agency. And it was hard. And there were several, you know, missteps where we'd have a department, it would blow up, you know, we'd lose the head of planning, we'd find a new, you know, it was difficult. But eventually we, you know, teamed up with a series of, you know, great strategy people. Mm. As a creative director, that's where the ideas flow from. You know, I can work, but I don't enjoy working without a strategy. And actually, I can't. I'll have to make up the strategy. Mm. Right. So for me, it all has to come from strategy, and the strategy has to be in service of the business problem. People would always ask us, how do you sell such wacky work? And it was never hard to sell, you know. It was always easy, because although it may have been, you know, it may have looked like it was challenging, it was designed to solve an actual business problem that the client really had. So often people, they're in advertising because they want to be filmmakers or writers, but they think advertising is going to be easier. And so they have little movies that they try to sell, or they have little stories they want to sell, you know, and they try to sell them over and over and keep trying to find a client who wants to buy that, you know, that little play. And, you know, we were never selling little plays. We were always being creative in service of commerce. So it was easy to sell because the clients could tell. And they could tell that if you didn't like this, we'd you know, do another one. For me, the other part of my process was to not get emotionally involved with the work that I was making. So if I made something and you killed it, I could not care less. I'd be a little sad to look, but usually account people were more bummed out than we were.
Mm.
And part of that was, and we would tell people, it's like, you have to have enough respect for your abilities that, you know, someone killing one of your campaigns is meaningless. If you get upset about that, you know, you're suggesting to yourself that you're not capable of coming up with another good idea. And it's like, I refuse to do that. I refuse to, you know, think that, wow, I can't come up with, of course we can come up with dozens of good ideas, millions, right? There's no limit. So it was less about how I or we would think about any one thing, and more about how we would think about the whole approach and our, you know, and our willingness to really be fearless in that engagement, right? And embrace change wherever it came from. A lot of creatives get so hung up, like the client changed something, which to me was always strange. I'm not always strange, eventually strange. At first I was, you know, I'd get upset too. But the longer I was in it, the more I thought, now, if one of us at the table came up with an idea to change it, we might love it. So why do we fear it when the change in creativity is very similar, you know, it's their cousins. Mm. And so when a change opportunity came, and it came internally, it was considered good news. When it was came externally, it was considered bad news. Why is that? And is that right? So, you know, eventually we just became so confident that, like, the change could come from anywhere and we would make it positive and didn't fear it. At first I used to have this, I felt like the best work was the work that was changed the least. And then later, you know, we would win awards for work and I was like, that, like, I just would remember how many iterations, and like, that is not only is it unrecognizable from where we started, it's unrecognizable from the script that went into production. And when you realize that that amount of change could still result in something, if you had the right process, could still result in something great, you had to fundamentally change the way you thought. It's something that's hard. It's a hard way to be when you're young, but I think that there's a way for young creators to kind of open themselves up more quickly, you know, and gain that confidence faster if they've got some good mentorship.
When it comes to, you know, that change and constant change, and how do you know when to ship? How do you know when it's right?
When you're out of time. I mean, we had a saying that, you know, the work's never done. It's only abandoned, you know? And so that would make clients crazy sometimes, and it would make account people crazy sometimes. But it's, I mean, nothing's ever really finished. I think most creative people would agree with that, you know, whether you're making a movie or writing. Like, you can always continue to adjust. But, yeah, for us, it's really, I mean, in advertising, you're lucky in a way, because it's like you don't even get to decide where that moment is. It just happens. So, but I don't remember ever being like, you know, finishing an edit 3 weeks ahead of the ship date or anything like that. You'll use that all the time.
I see. Well, look, let's shift gears and talk about, you know, Fearless Revolution and all the cool stuff you're doing there, because you've expanded your role from being, I guess, a brand advocate to being a consumer and social advocate. Can you tell us about that and the cool stuff you're doing there with that?
When I first stopped working at the agency, first guy to call me was Al Gore, and he said, which I thought was crazy, but that was literally the first person to sort of congratulate me. And he said, listen, I want a portion of your time, you know, anywhere between a small piece and 100%, you know, to work on climate. And he also said, look, you're going to transition, and that transition is going to take 2 years, whether you go surf every day or whether you try to work through it. It's going to take 2 years before you sort of find your footing again. And he said, you know, so you probably shouldn't work, but you should work with me. So it was pretty funny. It was a funny conversation. He's a really funny guy. Mm. And so we rebranded the Climate Alliance, Climate Reality, and we launched a web program, a web moment, a streaming web broadcast that called 24 Hours of Reality. At the time when we first did it, I think it was like the most viewed live web streaming event of all time. And they've done it since then and got even bigger numbers. They've done it every year since. But So I spent a bunch of time doing that, and it was fun, but it was hard, and it was really difficult for me coming out of an agency where, as a creative director, you're thinking about lots of different problems for about 15 minutes at a time, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go on the next thing and the next thing. And you kind of loop around, right? But, you know, you've got dozens of clients and you've got lots of projects. So your time's cut into these little bits. And it's some sort of form of professional ADD. And it would be a problem anywhere else, but in that role, you're well compensated for not being able to focus very long. And then I'm in this role, and it's like every day I'm thinking about climate. And it was hard for me, and it was not really a good fit. So after about 2 years, I helped them transition, find a new creative director, you know, build out the rest of the organization, and sort of, you know, that moved on. But I realized I need to move from problem to problem. I've spent too much time doing lots of different things, and I'm going to need to build that into like whatever it is I do. So a big part of that has been kind of my approach, which is not to be an operator in things, but to be an investor and an advisor in the things that I do. So find great people who I know, I love, that I want to work with, and they will operate, and I will provide hopefully a little bit of vision and some investment and ongoing advice. So that's how I've tried to kind of use the same skill set, but use it in a different way. And And that's shown up through a lot of tech startup work that we do. And alongside the tech startup work, it's a long answer to get to it, but alongside the tech startup work, I've also helped launch a few agencies. Fearless, which was kind of my you know, personal, I don't know, essentially a blog, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where I would do work with nonprofits, that's transitioned into an actual agency at this point. That is a partnership with Danye Scott and Leslie Freeman, who ran Insights for me at CPB. And they're like the most fantastic strategy people I ever worked with. So I knew they wanted to do a thing, and I'm like, man, you are going to be successful. I would love to, you know, partner with that. And that's what Fearless has become. And the focus there is on social causes. They both worked on Climate Reality with me, with Al Gore. Danye became probably, I don't know, one of really a great advisor to Al, and continue to work with Climate Reality at Fearless. But they also have clients like Annie's. Annie's, which is, makes mac and cheese and the little bunny crackers and stuff, the organic company. So there's kind of a spectrum of things that they work on over there. And then MADE Movement, which is another agency, they were launched a little bit before, a couple of years before Fearless. And MADE Movement's focus is American jobs. So that's another creative director, great friend, Dave Schiff. He and I used to meet in the morning and like, hey, what's a good idea for an agency? And try to come up with a lot of smart things. And then one day, and fail, try to come up with smart ideas and fail. Well, I'd come up with them, but no passion, right? And one day he looks at me and he's like, what I would love to do one morning? I would love to just work on Made in America stuff. And I'm like, well, Dave, you should always do what you would love to do, because you'd be more successful doing what you would love to do. And he's like, but it's the dumbest business model ever. And I'm like, you know what? It's like sacrifices, right? And so that's been fantastic, and they've grown like crazy. And I think they're like 80-some people now.
Mm.
And they do, they do everything from sort of a Harley Davidson, which you'd expect, but then a lot of food, which, creates a ton of American jobs. So that's their focus, and it's an interesting social play, because when things are consumed close to where they're made, it creates jobs, yes, but it also is a smaller carbon footprint. So it's a really interesting way to get at like that conscious capitalism piece, but a little bit differently than the way that they look at it at Fearless. And then other than the agencies, I helped create a tech accelerator here in town called Boomtown. And we're lucky that in Boulder we've got a tech accelerator called TechStars, which I think was maybe the first accelerator. And so we've got a big brother accelerator in town to look to, and super fun. We've run about 30 plus companies through the accelerator at this point. We're on our second fund, and busy right now. Actually, I'm here right now, and we're selecting companies for the next cohort. Yeah. And I love. For me, everything I loved about advertising, so much of where our success was, the ads were what people saw and noticed.
Mm.
But a lot of the creativity was in, how do we change the culture of this company to a culture, of failure to a culture of success, right? How do we show this company how incredible they are, how we see them, how their biggest fans see them, and let them see themselves that way, right? And the success really was in those moments, that advertising, that juicing the company from within, and that ability to fire them up and make them ready to win again. That was a lot of the turnaround that we would do. That was behind a lot of it. And then the ads would be obviously a huge part of it, but they would also be the most obvious and front forward facing piece of it. So that would get all the attention. But as an agency, as an organization, we were really good at helping your organization figure out what it should and what it shouldn't be doing. And when you get to work with these startups, yeah, they're two people, they're four people teams sometimes.
Yeah.
It's really cool to do the exact same process. And that's what I love that. And it's also fun to do it in a space where there is a lot of disruption. You know, I do enjoy that, hey, what's next for culture? You know, let's upset the big guys and let's change things up, see if we can't do it better.
Yeah, look, that's awesome. Look, Alex, really, really appreciate your time. I could talk to you all day, man, but we have to work towards wrapping up. I have a couple more questions, and that's just around, you know, now you're an investor, your advisor, you've got this seed accelerator, and you know, you're focusing on internet, mobile, software. I'm curious, you know, what are the things that you're seeing that I guess these early stage startups aren't doing, where they're struggling? What advice do you see yourself constantly giving?
That's a good question. The you know, it's not that consistent, but what one of the things that's nice is, so when I stopped working in advertising, one of the things I swear I felt my brain calcifying. Like, it was a period where I just felt like I was getting, like, just dumber and dumber every day. And because you didn't have that challenge. I mean, in advertising, it's really fun how challenged you are by new ideas all the time. And so, you know, for me, I wanted to get in the accelerator business because I just wanted to be exposed to the brilliant thinking that young entrepreneurs were bringing forward, right?
Mm.
And then realizing that there's so much stuff that I know that I don't even know I know, that to me is kind of obvious and a no-brainer, they don't see, right? So it can be around culture, it can be around team building, it could be around marketing, it can be around, you know, everyone wants me to work on branding.
Yeah.
But branding doesn't work until you've got everything else working. You know, you can't just put lipstick on a pig. So everyone thinks of me as like, oh, this will be my, you know, logo and copy guy. Not everyone. But whereas really, you know, where I'm going to help is in product. In advertising, we built a lot of products, usually for bigger clients, digital product. In the accelerator, you're building, you know, digital products from scratch, and you are a very small company with a very tough path towards customer acquisition, right?
Yeah.
And if I launched something for Burger King and if it was viral, terrific. If it was less viral, they didn't go out of business. At this stage, if you don't build your product in such a way that your product itself brings in one person and that one person converts to two people, then you're kind of dead. I think some early stage entrepreneurs get that and others don't see it as dramatically, and they also don't have it, you know, they can't have as much experience with product because, you know, I was just sort of tasked with doing it hundreds of times a year. So that product knowledge is and that wealth of seeing a lot of different things tried is probably where I think I add the most value. And then the other is, and this is a strange thing, but a lot of I've done really well, and I'm been so lucky in that. But I've never owned more than 20% of anything, right? And so many early stage people get really hung up on what percentage they own of a thing, and they don't bring in the right partnerships and help that can take it to the next level because they're just too tight, right? They're just too worried about their personal percentage, and it's basically they starve their idea because of it. And my advice is always like, hey, look, it's not, you know, having you know 80-90% of a thing that's not worth much, it's just not a good idea, you know. Like, don't choke this thing to death because you're so worried about, you know, what that percentage number is. It's, you know, it's all about creating value. So that's a space where if you have a little bit of experience, you can explain that to folks. But I just, you know, you can, I don't know, but you can imagine what it's like where it's just, you know, rooms full of brilliant 26-year-olds who have incredible technology, but maybe don't know how to do some of the simple things like open a bank account. So sometimes you can help with the most, with the most obvious stuff.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I'll be in touch, and hope you have a great day, great weekend. I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. As you might already know, our mission at Founder is to help tens of millions of people every single week with our content, either start or grow their business, which is exactly why we're partnering with world-class founders such as Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills such as negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free exclusive trainings, please go to founder.com/free. These are 100%. We go super in depth on teaching a particular topic, and I know that you're going to love them if you enjoy this podcast. So just go to founder.com/free. All right, guys, I'll see you in the next episode.